Tonight on Arena, new albums from Lady Gaga, RSAG and Psychic Markers up for review, and Anglo-Indian meets Anglo-Irish in Kovari Madhavan's new novel, The Tainted Country. @51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we'll start this evening with album reviews. This week's big release, of course, is the new album from Stefani Joanne Angelina Germanata. That's Lady Gaga to you and me. Her sixth album is called Chromatica. Next up, and quite by coincidence, Chroma is the very similarly titled album from Kilkenny-based drummer, songwriter, dance and electronic artist RSAG, otherwise known as Jeremy Hickey, and rarely seen above ground. And finally, London indie five-piece Psychic Markers follow their 2018 release Hardly Strangers with a self-titled album. Nadine O'Regan, Simon Marr have been listening, and we'll start with Lady Gaga. Played a duet from the album that featured Ariana Grande on Wednesday night's programme. Let's go for something by the lady herself to start us off. Get your dance shoes on for this one, actually, if you have them ready. Off you go now. We go. Stupid Love was the title of that track from Chromatica, the new album from Lady Gaga. As I said, Nadine O'Regan and Simon Marr are our reviewers this evening. Sadly, not sitting in front of me because I can't see whether they were chair dancing during that particular track or not. And thankfully, they didn't see me chair dancing during that particular track. Simon, I'll come to you first because I believe you're suggesting that this album, the best thing you should have if you're listening to this, is a set of 1995 Lidl disco lights. That's very specific. Is there something at home now flashing around as you're doing this review?
The truth always comes out during a review.
Sure does.
No, I just think there's what's great about it is that it's so utterly unapologetic about what it is. You know, you can tell straight away. It's like, okay, we listened to a whole lot of records in the 1990s. You know, we listened to a lot of disco. I listened, you know, listened to Madonna. I listened to Vogue, you know, and then decided I was going to launch my music career. Did it, and now I've returned from having done so much. When you think your last album was almost like country-esque, and then obviously there was A Star Is Born and everything in between. But this is just unashamedly disco. And yeah, get your little 1995 disco lights out for it.
Is 1995 the price, by the way, of the year?
Both.
Okay. I'm going to let that one go now. Sorry. Nadine, we're talking about, I won't ask you about disco lights. I'm really tempted to keep this going. Lady Gaga, she's a singer, she's a songwriter, she's a producer, she's an actor, she's a businesswoman. She's really, there's a huge amount to her, not just her disco dancing album that we're talking about this evening. Cultural icon, I think. Would that be fair to say?
A cultural icon, certainly. And also, by the way, Simon, I will just say, if you're short of the little lights, you can also get the bike lights and just put them into the sitting room. It'll do the job. And actually, this is the kind of album that I think sees her come back from a point where, you know, she actually struggled a little bit on the last record. It wasn't as well received. And then, of course, with A Star Is Born in 2018, her star also went back into the ascendant and she kind of recovered to some extent, because she had been flailing a little bit, to be fair. And this album sees her go back to what she is fundamentally best at, which is delivering a really tightly constructed, sophisticated album that contains a lot of heart. Their lyrics are universal without being cliched, and an amazing bunch of producers that are clearly killing themselves to give her the very, very best pop sounds.
Yeah, and not only producers, but a number of collaborators on this album as well, Simon. Ariana Grande, as I mentioned, we played the track from her on Wednesday night's programme. Elton John is in there, and K-pop superstars Blackpink are in there as well. Do all the collaborations work?
Do you know, there's three big collaborations, and you mentioned there Elton John. The Elton John one is grand. The Ariana Grande one is probably that bit better. But the one with Blackpink, who are sort of K-poppers, it's just one of those things that you find things that just work. And I think it's the combination as Nadine says, the producers that they've been brought on board. But when you put Blackpink in with her on Sarah Campbell, it just works so well. And it's what's amazing is that it works instantly. It's not as if it feels like it's been overly thought through or overly researched. It's obviously they just put these two together and it just works.
And despite your knowledge of the use of bicycle lights with this particular album, Nadine O'Regan, you had qualms about reviewing the album because of, was it the vocals you were worried about?
Well, do you know what? I think you can really admire an artist, and I do admire Lady Gaga. I've seen her live. I think she's brilliant without necessarily absolutely loving the tone of her vocal, and that's not something anyone can do anything about. You know, it's just a very, very, I suppose, personal taste as to the instrument that she has, that she's using. And so for me, a little bit, there are other artists whose vocals I prefer. And actually, it's one of the reasons I think Rain On Me, the track with Ariana Grande, is so successful, because I think Ariana brings this real kind of purring cat mentality to the track, where she sort of drapes herself over the track in this very sort of languorous way, whereas Lady Gaga does this almost robotic, intentionally robotic vocal, and the pair work really, really well together. But generally speaking, both Kylie and, funnily enough, Lady Gaga, I've always struggled a bit with just their bass vocal, but I think she uses it brilliantly here. And bear in mind, technically it's a great instrument. She's got tons of power. She's belting out where she needs to belt out. She's able to go into this almost really flat tone at times that is a little odd, and it is a little bit almost neutral in terms of, you know, is it male, is it female? And it's very interesting, actually, because of often what she sings about, because she is talking about the disco. She is talking about, I suppose, different genders, different times. And it's one of the reasons why she's so beloved by her gay audience as well. She is someone who is absolutely vulnerable, talking about her own love life, talking about her own feelings, and then setting it to the most amazing bunch of pop tunes.
All right. You both mentioned collaborators there. And Simon, you were particularly fond of the Black Pink collaboration, which has the wonderful title of Sour Candy. There we go. Sour Candy, the title of that track from Lady Gaga in collaboration with Blackpink. And that's from her new album, Chromatica. Of course, I'm not going to ask you how many stars, how many disco lights from you this evening, Simon Marr.
this is definitely disco-tastic. So I think this is worth four strobes out of five.
Bicycle lights from you, Nadine O'Regan.
Four bicycle lights.
Four. Okay, so you're both on four out of five for Lady Gaga and Chromatica. Let us move on then to our second album this evening. Quite, as I said in my introduction, quite by coincidence, very similar title to Lady Gaga's. This Lady Gaga's been Chromatica, and this album called Chroma comes from the artist RSAG. That is rarely seen above ground. And given that is it 10 years since its last full album, that kind of seems to fit in with the with the musical moniker of Jeremy Hickey. We listened to a track, given that we've had a couple of dancey tracks, so I'll slow it down a little bit now with Morning Sun from RSAG. Who's got it made? Morning Sun. Yes, very different sound altogether. RSAG, rarely seen above ground, and a track called Morning Sun from the new album Chroma. Who are we talking about, Simon Marr, when we talk about RSAG or rarely seen above ground?
Yeah, Kilkenny-based Jeremy Hickey, and he's one of those people that is very well known for his live performances, the rarely seen above ground live performances, where he tends to, I suppose, back himself and build the music from there, have been well known for a long time. But this is his first album that he's released. You mentioned earlier on, this first album that he released in 10 years' time. And I remember asking somebody about it back then, and they were saying it's a really good album, but it sounds like a drummer's album, because sort of percussion was his thing. But by the time we've gotten to now, we've gotten to 2020, he really has honed his craft. Mm. And he's come up with this album, which is just this amazing mixture of moods, if nothing else. And it's much more, I suppose, a much more fully formed version of him. And it's going to be one of those things that'll be fascinating to hear how it sounds in that live context as well.
Yeah, and so often when I come into studio and I have the joy of listening to these albums in studio setting, either with headphones or on the wonderful speakers that we have here, I hear the textures that I don't get at home on my own system. That track in particular, very layered, very textured, Nadine.
Yeah, and actually I think what's really remarkable about this album as a whole, it's 10 songs, about 45 minutes, is the pace throughout the record. There's a sense that he builds the rhythm eddies, and there's something about the way he drops different instruments in at different points that feels so remarkably cohesive. And I can already imagine him performing this live at Electric Picnic, if we were to have Electric Picnic, and it being a thrilling experience on, you know, a stage that will be like body and soul.
Yeah, and there are times, Simon, I think, obviously on the track we just heard, it's more like a traditional song with lyrics and, you know, he's saying something within the story or telling us a story there as well. But quite often the voice is just in there, almost like a type of texture.
Oh, absolutely. Like you're talking about layers upon layers. And one of the things that you would worry about when you do get involved in such layers and such textures, that it would become this overproduced mess. And it happens so often. But he's able to do that because of the fact, and this is the way that he laid the album out, track by track, that he kind of builds himself up to certain points and then lets himself come back down again. And you get something, as you mentioned there, something more traditional in the song before he works himself back up into more sort of textures and layers as it goes on. And it's beautifully done that way.
You mentioned also, Simon, the fact that the first album people spoke about a lot about drumming. Well, the drumming hasn't disappeared, as you will hear on this track, which is called The Jungle. There you go. The Jungle from RSAG and the new album Chroma. That's what Simon was talking about, I think, Nadine. You really get a sense of it in that track. He's done an awful lot in the space of the entire track is 3 minutes 46 and we listened to about 2.5, nearly 3 minutes of it there. He's done a huge amount in a very short space of time.
Yeah, it's a really extraordinary listen from the perspective of thinking, right, there's really just him and his co-writer, Jamie Walsh, is obviously hugely involved. But it's one of those albums that is genuinely thrilling at points. Like your ears prick up and you're thinking, wow, that is amazing. One caveat I would have, however, is that the drums are always quite high in the mix. So over the course of 10 tracks, that can get a bit wearying on the ear. But having said that, it's kind of understandable considering where he's coming from as primarily a drummer.
And I suppose it'll also be very interesting to see and hear how this might work in a live setting if we get there at some point over the next few months, Simon.
We will, yeah. And that's the thing. And when we do get back to regular life, and you get back to seeing gigs live, this is the sort of stuff that should come across really well, because he's able to do that as well as having, I suppose, this songwriting nous, you know, and having the musical ability. He has that sort of production skill where he's able to, in that live context, just put this stuff together in such a way as to make it a totally immersive experience. So I'm really looking forward to hearing this live.
And just before you give us stars, maybe you'd surmise as to whether you think, Nadine, he has a big fan base and a very devoted fan base. Will this bring new listeners to him and new fans to RSAG?
I think he sounds so vital on this record that for people who love bands like LCD Sound System, or for people who love maybe even artists like John Hopkins, RSAG will win a younger audience that didn't know him 10 years ago. And I think he will get those fans. He'll get those alternative fans who still very much want to hear new sounds. I don't think it's going to be mainstream, but I don't think he ever thought it would be.
All right. Stars then from you, Nadine.
4 stars.
4 stars from you. Summary and stars from you, Simon.
Yeah, I think this is a really strong return from Jeremy Hickey, and I think it's someone that's good, that is going to sort of stick in the memory for a good while. And I'm going to give it 4 cats out of 5.
Four what out of 5?
Cats.
Oh, 4
Kilkenny.
Cats. Oh, Kilkenny. Yeah, very slow, Sean. I was so busy getting ready to say not a bicycle light or a disco light in sound, but I forgot that the cats would make their appearance instead. That's Chroma from RSAG. Move on to our final album then for this evening, Psychic Markers, London-based indie five-piece. Last album in 2018 was entitled Hardly Strangers, but they're back with a self-titled follow-up. It's called Psychic Markers, of course. Here's a single from the album, a track called Clouds. And that is a track called Clouds from our third album this evening, self-titled album Psychic Markers. You know, I asked myself earlier today, who are Psychic Markers, Nadine O'Regan? And you asked yourself the same question. It's a hard one to answer in the usual fashion of the help of Dr.
Yes.
Google.
Yeah, and they're a funny one because, you know, it's their third album and they have said in their own press material that they hail from areas as far apart as Australia and Yorkshire. They're based in London. But remarkably, there really is very, very little about them online. And I discovered that they have 189 followers on Twitter, as they need to do a bit of work there. But having said that, they've clearly put their efforts and the focus into the music, because even though this could probably be considered, I'm guessing, a little bit of a side project for the individual members of the band, because they have all been in other bands over the years, there is a lovely cohesive quality to this album. It feels very assured, and it's a very absorbing listen. There's a touch of kind of David Cronenberg, and actually they've talked about him in interviews, that sort of filmscape sort of vibe. And there's also sort of elements of, I don't know, I mean, you could think of bands like, going back to Joy Division, I know it's a cliched reference, but it's there. Also, I guess that kind of psych pop element where you're listening, there's not necessarily a lot of vocals, but you're feeling very, the moodiness of it is quite appealing.
And a very distinctive vocal style from Stephen Dove. There's an interesting origin story on this one, Simon.
There is indeed, yeah. So Stephen Dove, the frontman of the band, was happily driving cross-country in the States, and he got caught in a sandstorm. And I think it's pretty much because he'd never been in a sandstorm before. He had no idea what to do. And he said that even though the sandstorm, as it crossed his path, only took a few seconds, it caused him to go through that whole idea of thinking about, Jesus, you know, life is short. And he says he gave him a new angle on everything. And that's why he decided that, well, this album, even though it's not their debut, this is the album that's going to be called Psychic Markers. Because now he says, I can see. I have been reborn. My eyes have been opened. And that's where this album came from.
Yeah, so in other words, he found out the reason he called the band Psychic Markers when that sandstorm happened is kind of what he's suggesting to us, is it?
I think, yeah, very rapidly he found it out, I think, yes.
The sound that they're giving us here, you gave us some reference points there, Nadine. Is it individual enough to stand out from the references that you gave us, the Joy Division, etc. references?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because putting on the album, you immediately think of, I suppose, in a way, also the trip-hop period, Massive Attack's Mezzanine, records like that. There's that moodiness, that minor key sort of melancholia. But over time, I guess, not to quote Tom Petty on you, but like, I don't hear a single, you know, like it aren't any songs that are so far above the pack that you can hear why this band needs to be big. And maybe that's not their intention, you know, maybe they're happy to have it as a kind of a moody soundscape. But I did wonder if the whole the album as a whole could be vastly improved if there was maybe a frontman that had just that touch more charisma or something to join the dots a little bit more, or maybe one or two tracks that were just so good that you had to tell your friends about them and you had to say, listen to this band.
Yeah, I mean, you've said, Simon, that you think there are enough good moments on the album to keep you there. But I'm just looking at the track listing. I meant to say with the Lady Gaga album, I mean, 16 tracks, I wondered had it overstayed its welcome. RSAG that we just spoke about, 10 tracks, and it feels it's just the right length of time. With this one, with Psychic Markers, 10 tracks, but I kind of, when I was finished listening, I thought, is that at all? Is there not another couple that you're going to give us?
Yeah, it does seem there is a definite sense of the album not being utterly complete. And it's interesting that even the single, the song, I suppose, that you played first, the single there, Clouds, appears as, you know, and every record man's nightmare is it appears as about song four on side two. They always used to say, look, you got to front load the stuff. If you're going to grab people in, you got to put this, you know, the big singles first on side one, first on side two. So it's as if, I don't know whether it's that they don't have the awareness yet maybe to put it together, or as to maybe it's a very deliberate decision that they say, look, this isn't our buzz. We just play the music and you either like it or you don't.
And this is the way they finish the album up when the track called Baby It's Time. That is the lyric. Baby, it's time to go. That's all we get for the entire 4.5 minutes of the track. But Nadine, you mentioned this cinematic idea. And as that started, I thought, it's not quite in the same crazy style of territory, but it's a touch of Ry Cooder and the music for Paris, Texas in there, that guitar.
Yeah, and the thing is, you wouldn't actually argue with the music that's here at all. It's maybe just that there's an incompleteness to it that if you saw that against the big screen with a beautiful shot, you know, it would absolutely hit you between the eyes. So in a way, it's kind of, I suppose what we're both talking about in a way is there's a sense of absence. So everything that's here is kind of really strong, but at the same time, you're going, yeah, is that quite enough?
All right. Stars from you, Nadine.
Three
from you. And from you, Simon?
You know, I think for the tracks on it that really, really are good, so the likes of Enveloping Cycles and Clouds and those bits, for some reason I love that final track. I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5.
A 3.5 from Simon Marr. Well, Simon Marr and Nadine O'Regan then, off to their Bicycle Lights and Disco Lights respectively, speaking to me this evening about Lady Gaga's Chromatica, RSAG's Chroma, and Psychic Markers, self-titled album Psychic Markers. Born in India but living in Ireland for the past 35 years, Kaveri Madhavan has just published her third novel, The Tainted Country. It opens with a fictionalised account of the Connacht Rangers mutiny in 1920s India. And Kaveri Madhavan joins me now. I'm saying the Connacht Rangers, but in fact, in your novel, Kaveri, we are talking about a fictionalised group of people called the Kildare Rangers. But maybe you just remind us of the Connacht Rangers story. And what was it about that story that caught your imagination?
Hi, Sean. Good evening. Thank you so much for having me on your show. The Connacht Rangers mutiny, you know, it's little known outside academia and historians and, you know, history buffs. But it happened in 1920 in India, this regiment that had such an amazing history of valor and honor. You know, they were posted in India several times over 200-300 years. And in the 1920s, when they were there, they mutinied, you know, this, I mean, it's not 100% definite that they mutinied because of what was happening in Ireland with the Black and Tans. But that was part of the reason, you know. And the mutiny was quelled very quickly because the Amritsar massacre had just happened, you know, a few months before, and the British were very keen to make sure that the mutiny wouldn't spread to other Irish regiments. So it was quite a sad thing, you know. Several men were sentenced to death, but only one sentence was actually carried out, and that was this young soldier, James Daly, from Tyrrell's Pass in County Westmeath.
And I believe actually he was then the last British soldier to be executed for a military offence.
That's right. Yeah, the very last. So that the 100th anniversary of that of his you know, of his death, and you know, the last soldier to be executed is coming up on the 2nd of November of this year.
So you then took that story as a starting point, but the Connacht Rangers don't exist in your story. We have the Kildare Rangers. I think you're living in Kildare, aren't you, Sam?
yeah. So what happened was, Sean, you know, I was a good say maybe a third way into the book when I, you know, planning to write the story of the mutiny. But you know, the more I researched it, I realized that the story actually lay in what happened after the mutiny. And so, you know, just for me to have a bit of fictional license, I decided to change the name of the regiment, and I turned them into the Kildare Rangers, because I live in Kildare, and you know, I've lived here for many, many years, 20 years. And my soldier comes from Strafford, where I live. So, you know, the story then, instead of being exclusively about the mutiny, actually, it's the story of what happened to all the children that were fathered by Irish people, Irish men, Irish soldiers and civil servants who went out to India and served in the British Raj. I mean, it's a little known fact that, you know, for the 300 years of the British Raj, Irish people, you know, were part of that, part of keeping the Raj going. You know, they worked in the military, in the civil service, in the railways, the telegraph, you know, all kinds of different things. And there was this terrible, you know, Victorian belief that you know, sexual abstinence in the tropics was dangerous.
So, which is why we find your character Michael Flaherty in the opening section of the book being sent off to sexually satisfy himself, or you know, he's been sent off to a brothel essentially.
Yes.
But he's a guy who couldn't cope with that, and that kind of gives us a sense of the perhaps a type of honour in the case of Michael Flaherty. I presume that's what you were intending. But the interesting thing is the fact here that this young Irishman, although he was British at that time, because we hadn't achieved our independence at that point, so he was part of the British Raj.
Yes,
he falls in love with a young Anglo-Indian girl, and that Anglo-Indian aspect is very important in the story that you're telling, and in, I think, some of the themes that you're exploring, Kaveri.
Yes, absolutely, because you know, I think being, you know, being mixed race, the problems of being mixed race has never changed. You know, what was then is now. I mean, it's, you know, it's playing out all over the world, as you can see. So, you know, it's a theme that has just, you know, it's a problem, not a theme, that's the wrong word. It's a problem, an attitude towards mixed race people that has just never has gone. You know, you're never part of your father's people, you're never part of your mother's people, you know. So, you know, in her case, Michael Flaherty falls in love with an Anglo-Indian girl, and she, you know, she's not white enough to be Irish, she's not brown enough to be Indian. And, you know, she's stuck like a lot of her community. This is not a fictional community. The Anglo-Indians are real people. They are the progeny of Irish, Scot, Welsh, and English men who, you know, who were part of the British Raj, whether they were military or civilian.
And Rose, who is your character, Rose Toomey is your character in the book. She's not without her own prejudices, and you could even say her own racist opinions.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the, you know, the one of the peculiarities of India, you know, because there's such an underlying caste, colour barrier, you know, that has gone on for centuries. So, you know, she's Anglo-Indian. She definitely considers herself to be several rungs above the ordinary Indian, you know.
The type of attitude that Rose and people of her class and of her ethnic background would have had was they wanted to be more British almost than the British themselves.
Yes, yes. I think, you see, for them, they, you know, they they saw their way out of poverty. They saw their way out of, out of the limbo that they were in India. The way out was actually to leave India, to physically leave India. And the prejudice was, they also were faced a lot of prejudice from Indians, So it wasn't from, there was a reason why they wanted to leave. Because they were very badly treated. I mean, I'd say only in the last 20, 25 years have Anglo-Indians, actually just, become Indians.
Yeah, which brings us to part two of the book, because part one of the book essentially deals with the story of Michael and Rose falling in love with each other and how that pans out. But that's for the reader to find out when they read. Part two of the book, we're in 1982. I do give a little bit away by saying there are two characters here called Toomey, Jerry Toomey and May Toomey, brother and sister. And obviously there's going to be a relationship of some kind with Rose. We also find a young man called Richard Elmer, and Michael Flaherty, who we spoke about in part one, he had been serving this Colonel Elmer when he was in the Raj.
That's right,
he was his officer. So we're in 1982, and we've a different type of attitude. How have things changed in terms of the attitude towards the Anglo-Indian?
Well, in 1982, they were still very much, ostracized. Well, not, I could say ostracized, because, it was, if you came from, a Hindu family, it would be so frowned upon to go out with an Anglo-Indian girl. My father was in the army, and I distinctly remember him telling me that as a young officer, they were not allowed to bring an Anglo-Indian girl to the officer's mess. I mean, how awful is that? So yes, in 1982 it was still definitely very prevalent, very very prevalent, bias against mixed race people.
And Richard, who is the grandson, I can't remember the exact relationship with Colonel. Grandson of Colonel Elmer.
Yes.
So essentially he's coming from an Anglo-Irish situation into May, who is the two generations down from Rose. She's the granddaughter of Rose, who we met in the 1920 section of the novel. Here we have that intersection of Anglo-Irish and Anglo-Indian. How similar do you think the two communities found themselves, or certainly the two that you give us, Richard and May?
Yeah, very similar, Sean. I think the only difference was that Anglo-Indians were poorer, than Anglo-Irish people. But otherwise, they face the same prejudice. The Anglo-Indians were never Irish enough. I'm sorry, Anglo-Indians were never Irish enough. They were never Indian enough. And then the Anglo-Irish were never English enough. Never were they Irish enough. The constant need to prove yourself, it's hard going, to constantly have to prove, prove who you are, your loyalties and where your loyalties lie. It made for a very confused community itself.
They themselves
would have been quite confused.
There's another little theme running through the book that I think I'd just like to explore before we finish up, which is Jerry Toomey, who is the brother of May.
Yes.
The relationship between May and Richard is the one we're following in 1982, and whether that will come to fruition or not. But he's a local forester. This gives you a chance, I think, to talk about something that it seems to me from reading the book is dear to your heart. It's a very different landscape. Jerry's grandfather had painted this area. Jerry is a photographer. He goes out to see the landscapes that his grandfather painted. They're very different.
Yes, yes. Yeah, because, the way the tea companies, mining companies, logging companies have just, run roughshod over this beautiful, absolutely pristine, it's unique biodiversity and it's kind of been labeled now in recent years as a unique biosphere in the world. There are particular areas called sholas, which have flora and fauna that is found nowhere else in the world. The Nilgiri Hills are such a unique, beautiful part of southern India, and this young Anglo-Indian forester, he's so committed to looking after it. It's like it's his own, his very own, backyard, you'd say, and he grew up there, so. I did a lot of research, and I was really taken up with the area. I mean, I am from South India originally, but I went back and I trekked a lot with a guide in the Sholas, and I just fell in love with the place, and I could see for myself, even, you know, in the years that I was there researching it, you know, how much of destruction had taken place because of the, you know, basically yeah. because politicians own the tea companies, the logging companies, the mining yeah. companies.
Yeah, it's a familiar post-colonial story,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
and the love of the region in India certainly comes across in the book as well. That's Kaveri Madhavan there speaking to us about her novel, The Tainted Country, which is published by Hope Road Publishing. Earlier this week, we spoke to the artist Willie Doherty about his piece Endless, featuring the actor Christopher Eccleston, that's been shown online by the Carlin Gallery. Well, the Carlin is not alone. It seems that galleries all over the world are doing their utmost to stay engaged by offering virtual tours and putting work online. The Irish Museum of Modern Art has added to this offering with a new online initiative called IMA On Screen. Alana O'Kelly's Sanctuary Wastelands is the first film work available to view as part of IMA On Screen, which went live on Tuesday. And joining me on the phones this evening, artist Alana O'Kelly and IMA's director, Annie Fletcher. Annie, first of all, explain what exactly IMA On Screen is and what you're hoping to achieve by it.
Thank you. Hi. Yes. To share the wonderful things in our collection in a new and intimate way. I guess we've all been forced to think off-site. We're not, you know, able to physically go and visit our exhibitions in the same way. And yet we love the possibility to share in an intimate way, you know, extraordinary works that are in our collection and things that we want to continually add to our collection. And so what we're offering is, over the next 6 months, a screening, a possibility to see films that, you know, are not normally online because artists are very sensitive and they want beautiful conditions for their work, rightly so. So they've generously offered us the possibility to put these works on screen, but we've also then commissioned the possibility to interview them. So they will talk about their work, think about their work, and the other added lovely thing that museums do so well is have archives. So we have lots of archival material, old interviews, different aspirations from artists around what they were trying to do at the time. So it's a really different perspective on how to experience artists' work.
Yeah, and I'll come back to you on some of the who the other five people involved in this are, but we do have Alana O'Kelly with us this evening, so let us speak directly to her about the piece that you have that we have as part of this initiative, Alana, Sanctuary Wastelands, a work from 1994. Just to tell us a little bit about it. You had just moved home from Britain, I think. You had been living in England at that time, and you'd come home. So what is this piece about?
That's right, Sean. Good evening. Yeah, this piece is one of a series of pieces that I made just after I came back from London, where I was doing an MA in the Slade. And this particular piece began as a tape slide piece, and with sound, with an audio track, a layered audio track. And I had visited Champalgoch Moor, the famine grave, but an older grave than the famine, but it was where famine people were buried as well. And I had visited that space a few times on a few occasions, and I was just really interested because at that particular time in the 90s, in the mid-90s, it was also kind of dissolving in front of my eyes. It sits in a really amazing part of the country. It sits, or it sat, on the edge of an estuary in Tullawan, in West Mayo, and the tide was coming in over a period of time, and the place was dissolving literally in front of my eyes. So I was kind of interested to see that and to talk about that place in particular.
Yeah, because Champalgoch Moor, the beautiful Irish title for our townland's name, translates as Great Sandbank. So obviously it was going to be swept away. Sandbanks don't last very long, really. Which gives us a kind of a sadness around, you're saying it was a slightly pre-famine, but essentially we're talking about a famine grave, that's such a commemoration, which in and of itself was often, you know, quite temporary, that it geographically here, it was just, you know, or ecologically, it was never going to last.
Well, yes. And the interesting thing, I suppose, we all grew up, in my generation anyway, we grew up knowing where graveyards were or where people were buried from the famine times. You know, every country place knew of a landscape or a field or a part of that was a burial place. And when I started looking at the famine and I wanted to look at some of these things, it was somebody from AFRI who suggested, Don Mullen suggested that I look at this one because they had done a walk. AFRI, excuse me, had done a particular walk along that coast in memory of a series of people that died along there. So it's a very poignant site for many reasons. Yeah.
And now there's a soundtrack aspect to this and we'll hear a little bit of that in the moment. But just tell us exactly what the viewer will see on screen. I think the film is about 10 and a half minutes long, somewhere in that region, isn't it?
It is. And originally, when it was made as a take slide piece, it was three projectors, and the first projector was a black and white negative image of the site itself, of the mound. And then what I did was, one of the times I was there doing some performance and being in the site, I filmed it. And so some of these coloured images I dissolved in and out of the black and white image, but just as tiny glimpses, as fragments of what you might see, because you might see it, but you also might miss it if you didn't know what, if you weren't looking, if you weren't listening to the space, you might actually miss that. And so the different times I was there, of course, as well, was really interesting because the site uncovered new material, new stuff, new parts of people's bodies.
Actually. Yeah.
There was a skull there at one stage. I went, and there were teeth at another stage, and that was really interesting because later, when I went to show the work as part of the IMA National Program, I went back when it was being shown in Lewisburg.
That's quite recently, was it?
Yeah, it was a few years afterwards, and they were doing a national program, and the piece turned up in Lewisburg, and I went back with Joanna Mullins at the time, and it was amazing. We were wondering, how many people would turn up, but it was great.
Yeah.
It was a great showing of it, but somebody in the audience actually described how when they went to the site at one stage, they'd heard it was a burial ground, and they came upon a tooth at that stage that was very old, from the 14th century. So it's obviously,
Now, I mentioned the soundtrack. I'm going to play this underneath as you're speaking here,
sure.
Alana.
Lovely.
Maybe you describe, because you will hear it as well at home.
Yeah.
Maybe you describe what you were looking for in the soundtrack, which I must say, as I was listening and watching today, I found very haunting in certain places.
Thank you, yeah.
So almost a kind of a primitive sound that you were looking for there, were you?
You know, that was really interesting. I was looking for some kind of prayer, actually. I remembered my father. We didn't say the rosary very often, but some of the memories that I have from my childhood was of my father saying the rosary into the back of the chair. And this wonderful mumbling of a sound would come out. So, but in fact, that particular sound you're hearing is a Tibetan chant.
So
it's personal and really interesting because I was working at that stage on the sound with Tommy Hayes. And so we incorporated the older sound of the prayer in Irish, which was Shedavavar, that lovely repetition of sound that would come out. And then the other sound, of course, was a lovely chant that we both knew. So it was.
Yeah, so I'll just let a little bit of that play out with none of us talking over it. So that's just some of the soundtrack that goes along with Sanctuary Wasteland, which will be available on the IMA website as part of this IMA On Screen initiative that we're speaking about this evening. Annie Fletcher, IMA director, you mentioned that there are six others. One particularly caught my eye when I was reading about it, Phil Collins, How to Make a Refugee from 2000. Tell me a little bit about that work.
I'm so thrilled that that's one of the pieces. It's exactly the issue somehow about how to connect us with our kind of global presence. He did this amazing project, which was around the Balkan Wars, the moment in Europe when everything was seemed to be exploding. It seems like a long time ago now. And he was literally looking at how photographers and the media were making refugees, where we're filming them. Obviously, they were there. They were in refugee camps. But he was interested in the exploitation of the camera somehow and his own role in that. So he did this very beautiful series of screenings of this endless sort of repetition of asking this young boy who had bullet holes in his back to show them again and again and again. So the relentless idea. And I just think it's really interesting. We can look back at the history of Europe, the world, everyone through our collection.
All right. So and there'll be each month over the next 6 months, there'll be a new artist featured. Vivian Dick is in there. Kevin Gaffney, Isabel Nolan, Phil Collins that we just spoke about there, Helen Kamak. And of course, did start off on Tuesday last with Alana O'Kelly. Thank you both so much for joining us this evening. That's Alana O'Kelly and Andy Fletcher of Emma speaking to us about Emma on the screen, Emma Screen, which is available on the Emma website, emma.ie. And that is our lot for this Friday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Olin McGann. Special programme for you on Monday. We're looking back to 1990, a bit of nostalgia for you. We went into our archives to give you that one. So have a great bank holiday weekend. We're back as usual live on Tuesday, but do tune in on Monday for a little bit of 1990s nostalgia.